Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Military people have been speaking to the politicians over the last couple of days, and they are now saying out loud what many Americans have been thinking for the past month or so, that there's a lot of work left to do in Iraq. So much work, in fact, that a good number of the soldiers who are serving there will be staying there, and for longer than most would have liked. A few days back, when General Tommy Franks was relinquishing his post at Central Command, he was talking tough about the challenges ahead.
As President Bush said recently, bring it on. That's been the attitude of this command, of this country, of the members of this powerful coalition for some 22 months, and we'll still stand and we'll still say it. Rough road behind, rough road ahead. Bring it on.
But after 2 days of questioning by anxious members of Congress and the Senate earlier this week, General Franks was sounding a little less confident.
I anticipate that we will be involved in Iraq in the future. And, sir, I don't know whether that means 2 years or 4 years. I just don't know.
Connection listeners, it is clear that America is settling into a long commitment inside Iraq. Are you ready for this? Are you thinking, bring it on, or are you ready to bring the troops home sooner rather than later? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're starting our program today in Baghdad. Simon Robinson is Time Magazine's bureau chief there. His cover story in this week's edition is called Peace is Hell. Hi, Simon.
Hi there.
You can hear me all right?
I can hear you fine, yeah.
Simon, is that what the soldiers are saying to you, that peace is hell?
It's very tough. I think that the transition from going from a fighting force to securing the peace is a very difficult one. And obviously the main thing that these guys have trained for is fighting wars and putting in schools, fixing schools, putting in new sewage pipes, securing infrastructure. That's not what they're really used to, but they're having to do it here in Baghdad and around the country.
So when you talk to them, are they saying to you, bring it on or bring us home?
Well, I think most of them miss home a lot, but a lot of them do say that they're here to serve their country, and that they're not kind of to the point yet where they're actively putting their hands up to come home. Some of them from the, especially from the 3rd ID, who deployed to Kuwait in late December and were obviously a big part of the war earlier this year. Some of them are now being rotated out, and those guys were feeling very anxious to get home. But others who have arrived since the end of the war, the conditions here are very difficult, and they're the first to admit that, but they are also pretty holding up pretty well, I would say.
Talk a little bit more about those difficult conditions, Simon, because we hear something on the radio news in the morning when an American soldier has been killed, or when there's been a rocket attack at a Humvee and some people have been injured. Are they getting a lot more harassment than we're hearing, people taking shots at them or throwing rocks at them, stuff that's not really making the news?
There are many more attacks than you hear about. We tend to only really hear about the ones that cause major damage or deaths. And every day there are attacks. They're fairly confined, I would say, to a triangle north and to the west of Baghdad. And in many parts of Baghdad, the troops can go about their business without any kind of harassment. In fact, the major harassment is kids coming up to them and wanting to talk or wanting to try out their English. So I would say the general population is not really any threat. But especially in convoys, when the troops are in convoys and small convoys of kind of soft target vehicles, unarmored Humvees, for instance, they're more exposed, and they're the kind of targets that are getting hit more often.
And Simon, just your own assessment, if you can help us out with this. When you look at the sort of level of nervousness or preparation that the American soldiers have to live with there, knowing that someone might be you know, taking a shot at them around the corner. Is that making it much harder for them to do the peacekeeping, the rebuilding, and the infrastructure work that they're supposed to be doing?
I think it's something that's always on their mind. I don't know if it's making it much harder, but it's something that's always there in the back of their mind, that anyone could come up to them, as we saw last week with a civil affairs soldier at the university in Baghdad. Someone came up and drew a pistol and shot him in the head. Those kind of incidents really play on the minds of the troops out here, so that when they're going about their work during the day or at night, they're always kind of nervous and thinking that something could happen. I don't know if it's affecting their work overall, though.
And what are the working conditions like for you, for them? How hot is it? How difficult is it to just make it from sun up to sundown?
It's pretty hot. Sun up starts very early, around 5 a.m., and the sun's starting around 5 p.m. And in the middle of the day, it can get up higher than 110, certainly between 120 most days, I would say. So it's very dry. It can be very dusty. The city, partly because parts of it have been
completed. Simon, I'm afraid we're losing that. We're losing the line, and so I'll take this moment to say thanks a lot for being with us. That's Simon Robinson. He's Time Magazine's bureau chief, reporting live for us from Baghdad. We're going to go next to Robert Perito. Robert spent more than 30 years in the U.S. Foreign Services. 9 years ago, he designed the U.S. police mission in Haiti, so he knows this transition, the sort of moment of moving from soldiers to policing. Currently, Bob is special advisor to the Rule of Law program at the United States Institute of Peace. Welcome to the program, Bob.
Good morning. It's nice to be with you today.
And thanks for being here. I want to also bring in Susan Wilder. Susan's joining us now from Fort Stewart, Georgia, home of the 3rd Infantry Division. She's manager of mobilization and deployment for Fort Stewart's Army Community Service. Hi, Susan.
Good morning.
You listened to Simon talking about the men and women of the 3rd Infantry Division, because they've been there for a long time. What are you hearing where you are in Fort Stewart?
From the families?
Mm-hmm.
They would like to have the soldiers home, of course. They miss their soldiers. But they understand that there is still an ongoing mission, that we are still at war.
I read something in the paper, I think it was this weekend, Susan, about some of the spouses actually confronting a colonel and saying, you know, we're not getting the answers and to the questions that we want. We're not getting the kind of information that we want. What was that all about?
When the 3rd Infantry Division received follow-on orders to move our troops into other areas, our forward deployed chief of staff came back to Fort Stewart to change command and relinquish his chief of staff to a new gentleman, go on to a follow-on assignment. And he had an open-to-the-public community meeting with families the day after the orders were issued. And he answered questions, and emotions were running very high. And our families understand that because this is a combat situation, communications are not the best. There's a lot of rumors that run around when soldiers are deployed, regardless of the area they're deployed to. And so Colonel Sterling did a great job answering those questions and putting the minds at ease of those family members.
Susan, what is the contact? How often can a husband call his wife or a son call his mother?
Well, frankly, it varies by the type of job the soldier does. If they're out on a maneuver mission, they're not going to be able to call as much. But if they're in what is called a D-main rear situation, they may be able to call more. I will tell you that communications from the forward deployed theater in Iraq with home back here has tremendously gotten better over the past several weeks. Our battalions have gotten satellite phones, so the soldiers are able to call their families more often. There is now some limited email access. Snail mail, as we call it, still runs slow, but it runs. And so there is much more contact now, and that's important for families to be able to hear from those soldiers.
We've actually got one of our callers calling in now from Lugos, South Carolina. Renee, are you there?
Yes.
And you've got someone overseas?
Yes, I do. I have a husband that was actually, his mobilization station was Fort Stewart.
Right.
And I got to go see him a couple of times while he was down there before he left for Iraq. And his original MOS, once he got over there, was for 90 days, which it looks like it's going to be extended, but we're not sure for how long. And my concern is that he's safe. I asked him last time I talked to him if he had to shoot his gun yet, and he said no, and thank goodness for that. He just has it with him at all times. But I would hate to think that a 90-day tour turned into 2 years or more. But since he's in the National Guard, I wouldn't think that that would happen.
What's your guess now, Renee? How long do you think his tour is going to be based on what you know now?
Well, what he has told me and what the Family Readiness Group has said is anywhere between September and December. But now that this new thing came out with between 2 and 4 years, what they'll probably do is what I'm thinking is they'll let them stay a while, bring them home since they're in a National Guard unit, and send some others in. So, I spoke to him this morning. There was about a month between when he left and when he got... there was a month there that I was not able to talk to him, but when he finally called, it was a relief. So, I'm just wanting to make sure he's safe and that they get their job done. They're working as hard as they can because they all want to come home. Mm. It's just there's a lot of work to be done.
How's he doing? How's his morale?
He's doing real good.
Yeah.
He's doing real good. He's always a happy-go-lucky person, so his spirits are real good. You know, we're sending lots of packages and lots of mail, so... He actually got some of my cookies that I sent the other day, and he said he got those within about 10 days. They were vacuum sealed, so they were still fresh. So he's doing real good. They're just working hard, and he'll be glad to get home when he gets home.
And how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I'm keeping myself busy, and I've got some family and friends here that give me lots to do. So it's okay. This is my first time with him being deployed, but, you know, it's... A lot of my friends say, well, I don't know how you do it. I couldn't do it. You know, you have to.
Renee, thanks a lot for calling in. Nice to have you on the program.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Bob Perito, you've been listening along with me to what Simon has to say, what Susan has to say. Are we in a kind of a really funny place right now in that transition from wartime to occupation?
Well, we're in a place where we haven't been exactly in previous instances like this, in that we... Normally, in the past, have had something of a buffer between the troops and the civilian population, and that buffer has been a international civilian police force, which has taken up some of the responsibilities of dealing with civilians. In Iraq, we don't have that, and I think it's placed our troops in a situation where they have to deal directly with civilians, and as many of these soldiers have said, they're not trained to do that.
All right. We're going to take a short break, come back, continue the conversation. Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. And you saw the photograph in the newspaper of the soldiers with their chins in their hand, finding out that they were going to be in Iraq a little bit longer than they thought. And you've heard some of the frustrations from people on this side of the ocean. And we're interested in hearing from you whether or not you are ready for a longer commitment in Iraq than may have been originally advertised. What are the challenges, both for the soldiers and for the people here in this country, and what lies ahead. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, and we're talking about the mission shift in Iraq and how that's going down in among the soldiers in that country and back here in America. Joining me on the program today, Bob Perito. He is author of a book called The American Experience with Police in Peace Operations. He's a longtime career diplomat with time spent in the State Department, in the White House, National Security Council, as well as in the Justice Department. Also with us, Susan Wilder. She's Manager of Mobilization and Deployment at Fort Stewart for the Army Community Service there. And Susan, maybe I can start with you if I can. I remember back in early April when the 3rd Division went, banging into Baghdad. They were the first in. It was what they were trained to do. There was a real sense of kind of pride and momentum. I talked to the soldiers just days after that. And I'm wondering whether or not that's soured a little bit in the weeks that they've been under the sort of sniping and doing work that they're not necessarily trained to do.
I don't think so. The follow-on mission and the non-return of them at the end of the ground combat was a disappointment. But our soldiers at the 3rd Infantry Division are by far some of the best trained, and they understand that they have a job to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they were disappointed. Yes, they want to come home. Their families want them home. We want our men and women in uniform home, but they understand that this is their job. And the patriotism around Fort Stewart and Hunter Army Airfield is still running incredibly high.
How do you see that, though? I mean, when I hear a radio report or see something in the paper of, you know, a wife or a kid saying, gee, I want my dad home, where do you see the patriotism? How do you
in the civilian community in both Hinesville and Savannah, Lutawisi, Long County, Bryan County, the flags are there, billboards are up,
right.
Welcome home, Fort Stewart, great job, troops, just it's incredible. We brought home about 900 of our 24th Corps support over this past weekend, and the welcome home was incredible for these men and women.
Bob Perito, I wonder if I could hear you on the same question on a sort of a larger scope here, that when you are asking soldiers who are trained specifically to work in combat, what are the problems that you do get into when you turn those people into policemen?
Well, first I'd like to say that, you know, the third idea did a marvelous job, and we owe them a huge debt of gratitude, and it will really be good when they do come home. I think we have to go back and take a look at the difference between police and military, and that, I think, is at the core of this. Soldiers are trained to mass power to destroy the enemy. They're trained to act instinctively in situations where it's kill or be killed. Police are trained very differently. Police are trained to preserve and protect. Police are trained along what's called a force continuum, to use only that amount of force that's required in order to control the situation. Police do not use deadly force except in situations where it's the last resort and they need to do that to protect themselves or others. But primarily, police are trained to deal with civilians. Soldiers are trained to deal with enemy armies. And it takes a great change of mindset to switch from a situation where you've been in combat with a given population, particularly in situations where you're dealing with irregular troops such as the Fedi and Saddam, to a situation in which you're asked to display compassion and to make a lot of judgments about people that are either might be hostile to you or might really need your assistance. So I think that's really where we are right now.
What's the difference in training? What kind of police training do the soldiers get?
Well, soldiers don't get police training, except in the case of military police, who are trained both as infantrymen and as police officers.
Right.
But soldiers don't get that training. In fact, they get training which is very much different. Let me give you a couple of cases which might bring this home. One occurred in 1993 in Los Angeles during what were called the riots that occurred there.
Right.
The so-called Rodney King riots. And in that situation, the riots overwhelmed the Los Angeles Police Department. The National Guard was activated, and then finally federal soldiers were sent in, Marines and airborne. In one instance, there was a mixed group of LAPD and U.S. Marines out on patrol. They came past a building. They heard shots fired in the building. They all crouched down. The senior police officer turned to his military counterpart and said, I'm going into the building. I want you to cover me. The police officer took about half a step and then froze because the Marines, true to their training, did just that. They laid down a barrage of automatic weapons fire and just tore the front off the building.
Which is exactly what they would do in a combat situation.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, clearly that's not what cover me means to a police officer, but it's certainly what cover me meant to those Marines. And I'll give you another instance that proves this point, and that's if you remember the sniper incidents in Montgomery County earlier this year, there were several instances where people were shot and that there was a policeman close by. In every case, the policeman went immediately to the victim to shield the victim and to assist the victim.
Mm-hmm.
A soldier in that situation, if he remained true to his training, would not have done that. He would have gone after the sniper. He would have gone after the threat. And both of these individuals, the soldier and the police officer, are trained to protect the community, but to do it in very different ways.
All right. Interesting, different perspective. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Boston, and David's joining us. Hi, David.
Good morning.
Thank you for calling.
My pleasure.
Tell me what you think.
Several things. One is that I wish we were not in Iraq at all, but if we were to leave, I think that we would be perceived as weak, and we would be more vulnerable because of it. On the other hand, I think that staying there, we have the sense is much more of one that we are oppressive liberators rather than empowering liberators. Some of my colleagues have done an assessment of President Bush's statements about the Iraqi people, and when that analysis is done, it appears that he almost is speaking about the Iraqi people as an afterthought. We are the liberators, and oh yes, there's people there who we're liberating, but there's no compassion, no sense of real faith and respect for the humanity that the Iraqi people are, and that hurts. And I think that
that's at the soldier level, David? Or are you talking about at the administration level? Because I want to be clear about what you're saying here.
At the administrative level, but I have many friends who are in the military, not anyone who is a soldier in Iraq right now, but I get the sense that they're trained to be, which they have to be careful and defensive and be very, very, very vigilant and keep control. But I have this dream wish that they would also, part of their training would be to include as many statements or interactions which say to the Iraqi people, please help us, the Americans, able to leave your country. Please take control. We are only here to help, and have the in such a way that wherever there's an opportunity, the Iraqi people really believe that the soldiers want to leave because they have faith that the Iraqi people can take care of themselves. Use us. I wish the American soldiers would say, use us to help you. What do you need? Rather than us saying, here are the things that you need. That's an oppressive liberation, not an empowering one.
Let me hear, if I can, now from Susan Wilder, because, Susan, you're listening in, and you, by dealing with the spouses on a regular basis, will have some insight into, you know, the awkward kind of position that the soldier has, wanting to protect himself, as Bob was saying earlier, and as David's just saying now, trying to express some of that compassion. But how do you do it if you're hunkered down on the top of a Humvee?
Well, first I want to preface this by saying I'm certainly not a war planner, and I'm certainly not in the Iraqi theater. However, we get routine reports from our battalion and brigade forward commanders who are with these soldiers on the ground.
Right.
And what we're hearing is not that. We're hearing that there is tremendous compassion, that they are stopping and talking to the children, and that they are interacting with those men and women in Baghdad and Fallujah and all of those areas. They are bonding with those, interacting with them as if it were, to some semblance, a peacekeeping mission like Bosnia and Kosovo. Our soldiers, although trained for combat, are also humans, and they have been interacting.
I think we have to be clear about what we're up against. The people that are carrying out the attacks on our troops in Iraq are not ordinary civilians. It seems increasingly clear that the security services and elements of the Iraqi military and perhaps even common criminals and organized criminal groups survived the conflict. These groups have coalesced, and it's these groups that are carrying out the attacks on our soldiers.
Yeah, but how would you know? I mean, if you're, like the young kid was, on guard duty in front of the museum, you're going to have a steady stream of people coming and going, and you're not, I mean, the Saddam sympathizers aren't in uniform. They all look like civilians.
That's true. But I think it's important that we identify what the problem is, and in order to deal with it effectively.
Right.
As the Time correspondent Simon said, we're dealing with a situation in which the primary problem is located in a specific geographic area in Baghdad and to the northwest, which is a Sunni area made up of people who were loyal to Saddam. The rest of the country is fairly quiet right now. In that quadrant where we're having the problem. I think we are discovering, and if you read the things that Tommy Franks has said in the last couple of days,
right,
it's becoming more clear that what we're up against is an organized resistance. And so if we identify the problem correctly, there are ways to go after it.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Elizabeth City, North Carolina now. Marjorie's joining us. Hi, Marjorie.
Hi.
Thanks
how
for
are
calling.
You?
I'm fine.
Thanks for taking my call.
How are you?
I am trying to hang in there. It's been about 6 weeks since I heard from my fiancé, who is in the 464 Armory of the 3rd ID,
right,
and out of Fort Stewart. And I think my concern is that not hearing from him. And the other concern is that they went in, like, with the 3rd ID at the beginning of the war. And that shift in mindset might have a psychological problem, you know, long-term psychological problem with them having to shift from being soldiers, you know, fighting, to being police officers. I'll be so glad when he comes home. He went through Bosnia and now Iraq, and he is a career soldier, and I'm patriotic. I support the troops, and I have a great deal of respect for what he does, but I'm missing him terribly.
Are you thinking, Marjorie, that given what we know of what's going on in Iraq, that he is in sort of regular danger there?
Yes, I do. I do believe that he's in danger because of the hostility. And even though he's very professional and a very likable people person, he can't distinguish between somebody coming up to him to say hello and somebody coming up to him and pulling a gun on him.
So how does he react in a situation like that? Would he just stand off and I mean, you say he's a professional soldier. He knows what he's doing.
I'm sure he knows what he does, and that's what he's supposed to do. And I am very supportive of what he does, but they were supposed to come home in June. And the last thing we heard that they were going to be home the middle of June. And we were all geared up to have him home the middle of June. And now we don't even know when he's coming home.
Nobody's saying it's going to
Nobody's
be August or it's
going
to be September.
Nobody's saying when they're coming home. And having not spoken to him in more than 6 weeks is really a worry to me. I mean, I write regularly, but I have not gotten any. Like, I don't know if the letters are going through because I've not spoken to him.
Thanks a lot for your call.
Okay.
I want to ask Bob Perito whether or not there are systems in place that are supposed to provide, you know, that better contact, the better information, or whether or not the price that Marjorie's paying is the price of this country being at war.
Is the question concerned what kinds of systems that the military may have in place to keep families informed? And if so...
And to keep people in contact with each other. Because, I mean, what I hear from Marjorie is, A, that it's been 6 weeks and she'd really like to talk to the guy. But two, you know, give me some information. Give me a date. Give me something I can look forward to.
Well, you know, yesterday in his appearance before the House of Representatives, General Frank said that the last brigade of the 3rd ID would be back home in September. After 2 days of questioning before the Congress, both the Secretary of Defense and General Franks have been more specific about when that particular unit is returning. So I think, you know, there's some hopeful news there,
right,
in that appearance.
So I guess what I'm wondering is, you were talking earlier about the contrast between police,
mm-hmm,
and soldiers, and, you know, Susan was making the point that when they're out on maneuvers, you know, nobody's packing around a cell phone. They can't check in, see
That's
how
right.
the kids are doing. But does that change at all under a policing situation in terms of the expectations of time, the ability to contact a loved one?
Well, it certainly is affected by the availability of communications. And one of the problems that's affected the entire post-conflict effort has been a problem with communications. It's been hard for the civilian administrative element to communicate with each other. One of the comments that have been made by people who were part of General Garner's team initially, mm-hmm, that are now coming back to Washington is that there was it was very, very difficult for them to communicate with each other. So this, as we heard from the other person who's on the line with us, you know, it's getting better in the right. last few days. But I think this is really a major problem just generically with the situation there.
And Susan, it strikes me when I listen to people like Marjorie and others talk about, you know, just how important that phone call, that mail, the cookies, the contact is under circumstances like this. I guess it's something you spend a lot of your time working on.
It is. And, you know, I want to just remind everyone of one thing. Although President Bush has declared ground combat over, we are still a country at war. You know, there is nothing more important for a soldier's morale and family's morale than letters, packages, phone calls, and email. And the Iraq theater is such an underdeveloped, brand-new theater that it is going to take a while to get the infrastructure built and to get the communications requirements up. But you're right, we do battle this on a daily basis. You know, depending on the type of activity that a soldier does, the type of job he does, an armor soldier will be out in a maneuver area more than, say, a signal soldier will. And so not everyone is hearing from their soldiers. And on a daily basis, we encourage our families to try to remain patient. There is a light at the end of the tunnel. General Franks has said that our soldiers will be coming home, and we're preparing and starting to prepare those soldiers and their families for that reunion.
And when General Franks says to a committee, you know, the commitment, though, may be for 4 years. Are there people in Fort Stewart going, whoa, he's going to come home and he's going to go out again?
Yes, and I think deep down in most families' hearts, they have known that this will be probably a long-term effect. What will the effect be on the 3rd Infantry Division at this point? We have no idea. The anticipation is from the families that eventually brigades from Fort Stewart and Hunter Army Airfield will rotate back into the Iraq theater in a quote-unquote peacekeeping mission rather than a combat mission. And yes, operational tempo is a huge concern for our families. When is he going to have to go again?
Susan, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Susan Wilder is Manager of Mobilization and Deployment for Fort Stewart's Army Community Service. Connection listeners, our customary break at this time each hour, but we want to hear from you when we come back. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We're continuing our conversation with Robert Perito about the commitment that is being made in Iraq. We heard it from Secretary Rumsfeld. We heard it from General Franks this week. In many ways, the most stark confirmation that the commitment made to Iraq is going to last a number of years. And we'll talk about different ways of dealing with that. And here's some of your ideas when we come back. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. The question this hour, are you ready for occupation? Confirmed this week in no uncertain terms by General Franks and Secretary Rumsfeld that America's occupation of Iraq will last years, not months. 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to hear from you. My guest this hour, Robert Perito. He is author of The American Experience with Police in Peace Operations. He's got a book coming out. The catchy title. It's called Where is the Lone Ranger When We Need Him? America's Search for Post-Conflict Security. Bob is a special advisor to the Rule of Law Program at the U.S. Institute of Peace. That's a congressional institute promoting peaceful resolution of international conflicts. And Bob, I'm curious in hearing from you about one of the ways that I think about this, and it happens almost every morning when I get up and turn on the radio and I listen to the lead story, which, and I guess today was an exception because there wasn't a story like this, saying, you know, another soldier was killed overnight in Baghdad, or three more people were injured when someone fired at their vehicle. That's becoming a very, very regular occurrence now. And I'm wondering, in your experience, how you see that type of news changing this.
Well, it's very clear, as I said before, that we're up against an increasingly organized resistance that's carrying out attacks against our troops that are demonstrating increasing amounts of sophistication. So, you know, obviously there are ways to go after such a resistance, and it takes military discipline and organization. It takes identifying the ringleaders. It takes investigation, using informants, figuring out who's responsible, and going and taking these people out of service. This is something which is different than we've encountered in other experiences that we've had. We did not run into this in the Balkans, and we didn't really run into it in Haiti. We did run into it, however, in Somalia. And what we did there was to internationalize the force, to bring in other countries. We moved very quickly to stand up an indigenous police force that took over patrolling and relieved our soldiers of that responsibility. And we worked very hard on the political process. And all of these things are going to have to be done in Iraq, and they're going to have to be done with some sense of urgency.
What's the danger or the risk for the politicians as well as the generals that as we're watching public support go down almost by, you know, 5, 10 percentage points a week as these stories continue to come out about, 18, 19-year-old soldiers who were just picked off by pistols?
Well, I think it's very important that the administration set the stage here and, as other people have suggested, explain to the American people and to Congress what's involved. I think the American people will be willing to support an effort if they understand what the risks are and what the length of that experience is likely to be. And it's very important also that we do this for the Iraqi people as well. Mm-hmm. We've been very reluctant so far to give the Iraqi people an insight into our game plan for the future of Iraq. And only yesterday did the U.S. administrator,
Mr. Bremer,
say that we're now going to proceed ahead with the organization of an Iraqi governmental or government advisory council, which is going to take on increasing responsibilities for at least civilian administration in Iraq. I mean, these are positive steps, and they take some of the pressure off. They make us look less imperial. They make us look more like a partner in a long-term peace process.
Let's go back to the phones to Medford, Massachusetts now. Peter's joining us. Hi, Peter.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Listen, I heard the call, and first I want to preface my remarks by saying I was hoping when the war started that we didn't have to send the troops in or before it started, but now that we're in, we have to support the troops 100%. My observation as a combat veteran is I don't understand the justification of the administration now, those areas where the pockets of resistance where the soldiers are being shot and killed, why they are not more aggressive. And I wonder if the administration is trying to be politically correct because of fearful of bad publicity, that why they're not more aggressively patrolling and taking the arms off these people.
Let me interrupt you, because if you're a veteran, imagine yourself in the situation there. Say you were commanding the soldiers, and if you went in and used a lot of force in order to try and push back against these people who are, you know, plunking away from windows of warehouses, isn't there a risk that you just cause more of that kind of organized resistance?
Well, I thought it's like certain areas, and so I'm not talking about the whole country. I'm saying that there's certain areas that they need to be more aggressive for, and I think they should be disarmed. And for example, the areas where the hot spots. I'm not talking about the whole country, but those areas, I don't see what justification allows these people to keep weapons. It didn't happen certainly in Vietnam. I'm in Vietnam. I mean, that was an aggressive war. I mean, if you saw an NVA or VC with a weapon and you shot him dead, you didn't take prisoners. If you could kill him, you kill him. Yeah. And you eliminate the end. But the point I'm wondering is the administration, are they fearful? Are they not allowing, for example, I think in the Marine Corps, you would have, are they not actively pursuing and tactically going out and setting up like sniper patrols to actively engage these areas and kill these people? And that's what it's about. You got to protect the people by killing them. But, I mean, they have weapons. I'm not talking about the whole area. I'm talking about certain areas.
I got you on that one, Peter. I want to hear from Bob Pareto on this one. Bob.
Well, I think one of the differences between the Vietnam conflict and the situation we find ourselves in Iraq is that the area in which these attacks are occurring is an urban area. And so urban warfare is the most difficult kind of warfare, particularly in really highly developed urban centers. So some of the tactics that may have worked in Vietnam, I don't know where our caller served particularly, but I mean, most of Vietnam was a situation of small villages and rural areas. So that may be a problem. The other thing is that the military has been undertaking aggressive action. They have been patrolling. They have been doing sweeps. But when you get into the business of kicking down doors and going in and searching people's homes and looking under the beds for weapons, you very quickly create animosities, particularly in a Muslim environment where there are all kinds of social and religious strictures about contacts between men and women. So the military has to proceed with some caution here, lest we create more of a problem than we have already.
You're saying is that you can do both, but it's difficult and it's delicate and you have to be careful?
Also, it's important who you have do it. Just going back to the importance of including police in a post-conflict operation, the presence of police officers is generally a reassuring presence. There was an incident recently in the South involving British forces where a crowd objected to British paratroopers patrolling through a market. This led to a very unfortunate situation in which a mob attacked a police station in which there were British soldiers inside who could not get out. I'm making an assumption here, granted, but I think it would have been different had that patrol going through the market been a police patrol, an international police patrol. The image that it would have projected would have been different. Policemen are expected to go through markets. That's the job of police officers, particularly if it was a mixed patrol of international and local police officers. That generally is seen by people as reassurance to have a police force around that's looking after them and protecting them. It creates a whole different impression than having a group of soldiers go through and perform the same function. So we've been very slow about bringing police online in Iraq. There are no international police there now. There are only about half of the Iraqi force stood up, and that's not being done with great efficiency.
So yeah, no, the only people that I saw when I was there were the Iraqi traffic police. I mean, certainly it's difficult for them to get the other people who are in uniform. I want to get back to our phone lines, if we can, to Columbia, South Carolina. Bob's joining us. Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, having spent 31 years in the Marines, both as enlisted and as an officer, I can tell you that if you put a Marine infantry battalion doing police work, they're going to get the results you got in L.A. Not because they don't want to learn, but they're naturally meat eaters. They're not, you know, milk drinkers. And that's just how they're trained from the time that they're a baby Marine at Paris Island or San Diego.
So the wrong troops are in Iraq right now. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. One of the things that I noticed the other day was an artillery unit was sending out patrols to patrol the streets of Baghdad. Heavy artillery units, they get almost no training in even urban warfare because they blow things up. They don't need it. But, you know, the Army's got them doing it. Well, that's an Army problem. By the way, Army people are soldiers, Marines are Marines. And I noticed in the media, you guys have a hard time telling the difference between them. You call everybody soldiers. If I want to be a soldier, I'd join the Army.
I take your point.
There was a case the other day where a soldier was complaining that he was trying to chase down a person who'd stole a car, but he was driving a Bradley fighting vehicle to do it. And you know, that there's clearly a mismatch here, and that's clearly contributing to the problem.
Yeah, and you hear from soldiers and Marines that the vehicles that they have to drive aren't the sort that you would, you know, go down the side of the street to make sure everybody's okay. You can hear them coming from six blocks away. Let's see if we can get one more call in. This is from Boston, and Tom's joining us. Hi, Tom.
How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. It's an interesting conversation in that my brother is currently in Iraq, and we're not extremely close. I don't know even what unit he's with. He's in the Army. And, you know, we're not surprised at all to hear this news. He told us, you know, we're going to be there for years and years and years. You watch, because, you know, this isn't just about removing Saddam Hussein. This was one of the potential oil pipelines for the Caspian Sea finds, which are the biggest, you know, oil supplies outside of the Middle East. And this is one of the potential three routes outlined by John Noreska to the United States.
So what you're saying is that the soldiers and the Marines knew before they went in, even what the politicians were.
I don't know about all. I'm saying, yeah. I'm saying my brother said, hey, look, you know, like, watch. We'll be there for years and years and years. This isn't just a few months.
Bob Parita, I wonder,
because of the resource.
I want to turn to Bob Parita here and just, is there a way of using the soldiers to you know, counter the attacks, the organized attacks that we're talking about, and bring in blue berets, blue helmets, international forces at the same time? Or isn't there the risk that if you're putting people out there in open jeeps to say, hey, we're police, we're here to help you, that they're going to end up being targeted just like the folks who are wearing body armor?
Well, if you look at the experience we've had in previous peace operations, there is an approach that we've used which has worked, and which is an approach that I've recommended, and that is that we begin the transition as soon as we possibly can in areas where we have stability, which is most of Iraq today, from military to civilian police forces, starting with civilian constabulary forces. These are police forces with military characteristics, such as the French Gendarmerie or the Italian Carabinieri, and then in bringing in international civilian police, and finally teams of judicial officials and corrections officers, and with the intent being to stand up the Iraqi judicial system and getting it functioning again. This is what we did in every instance, starting with Panama and running through Kosovo and East Timor. The long-term impact of this, and I'm talking about maybe a period of a year or more, is that eventually the troops are allowed to depart. The responsibility for internal security shifts over to civilian law enforcement authorities. The situation then becomes more of a normal situation that exists in other democratic countries. And eventually, under the tutelage of an international force, the Iraqis or the local population is able to take over. And that's what's happened in Bosnia and Kosovo. In Bosnia, also, what's happened with our military there is there's been a transition over time from the initial heavy armor units that went in 1996 at the beginning of the Bosnian effort, where we had 60,000 troops, to a point where today we have about 3,000 to 5,000 troops. They're all National Guard troops. These are citizen soldiers. Most of them are older. They have civilian skills. They're plumbers, bricklayers, carpenters, policemen, whatever. They take very readily to the kinds of responsibilities of economic reconstruction and rebuilding, political reconciliation, dealing with civilians. They become very effective ambassadors for the United States. You know, these techniques are there. We've used them in the past. They're available in Iraq today, and we should begin to marshal these appropriate forces and employ them. So far, however, we haven't done that.
Bob, thanks for being with us on the program. Good to have your
insight. Thank you.
Bob Perito is author of The American Experience with Police in Peace Operations. Earlier in the hour, we talked with Simon Robinson, Time Magazine's bureau chief based in Baghdad, and Susan Wilder, manager of mobilization and deployment for Fort Stewart's Army Community Service. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.